Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What we got today from the president-elect was a good old-fashioned talking to. Stern, no-nonsense, hurry up and get things done, that kind of speech. But is it rude to tell the president-elect, be careful what you ask for? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 8th of January. Great to have you with us. On the one hand, it was a typical presidential speech that Barack Obama gave today. Lots of new programs and big promises. But there was a very definite message, too. Now. Congress has to get going now on his economic stimulus plan. But doesn't anybody else remember what happened last time Congress rushed to authorize $700 billion? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
The president-elect painted a dire financial future if Congress fails to enact a huge government spending program for roads, education, health care, and technology.
If nothing is done, this recession could linger for years. The unemployment rate could reach double digits. Our economy could fall $1 trillion short of its full capacity, which translates into more than $12,000 in lost income for a family of four.
Obama's warning was only slightly less ominous than President George Bush's pitch for the Troubled Asset Relief Program last September.
The government's top economic experts warned that without immediate action by Congress, America could slip into a financial panic.
Congress approved $350 billion for TARP, although those troubled assets were never purchased. The Treasury Department decided instead to make direct investments in banks. But Alan Levinson, the chief economist at T. Rowe Price, says this time Congress will ask for more details.
The TARP was, give us the capacity to do something, we're not sure what. I think that there's going to be a little bit more specificity about what Congress is enacting than with the TARP.
And Levinson says the next president is less inclined toward hyperbole.
Obama is, by his nature, not a person to try to sow panic with those kind of statements. He doesn't want to use words like catastrophe, panic, crash. But putting a number on it, like $1 trillion, does get people's attention.
Congress is no longer expecting to have a stimulus package ready by Inauguration Day. More realistic predictions are for the middle of February. The momentum is there, if not all the specifics. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We've all kind of known for weeks, but today we got the numbers to back it up. This was officially one of the worst holiday shopping seasons on record for everybody, too. Barnes & Noble, Target, even Walmart was off expectations. Macy's said it's going to close nearly a dozen stores, and the high end didn't do any better. Sales were off 28% at Neiman Marcus. Even triple markdowns and 75% off sales couldn't get consumers off the couch. And Stacey Vanek Smith reports that leaves retailers playing a game of expectations.
If one of your resolutions was to only buy things on sale, no problem. All of those year-end discounts have given way to New Year's discounts.
No consumers are thinking about buying anything at regular price.
Britt Beamer is the author of The Customer Rules. He says we've become a nation of sale-aholics, and anything less than half off just doesn't do it anymore.
That's now the new threshold. 50% off is a good sale, 70% off is a great sale.
Beamer says that sale junkie mindset has hit retailers hard. Stores are practically giving away what's left over from winter, and some have already started cutting prices on new spring merchandise. Marion Freestead studies consumer behavior at the University of Oregon. She says even consumers who have money are holding back.
The media coverage of this tells people that there may be even deeper discounts coming. So consumers are smart. They're willing to wait for that.
That waiting has retailers in a serious bind, says Conference Board economist Ken Goldstein.
They can sell merchandise or they can make money. Question is, how can they do both at the same time? And right now, for a lot of firms, there is no way.
Goldstein points out that dozens of major retailers like Mervyn's and Linens and Things went bust in 2008, and high-end chains like Saks and Neiman Marcus are on the ropes.
We've already seen a number of fairly big firms and chains go out of business. There's going to be more before this is over.
Goldstein says many retailers are still struggling with too much inventory. That could mean many more months of markdowns and razor-thin profits, and another good year for shopaholics. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
As if seeding the world's financial system with subprime debt wasn't enough, today the American computer industry gave Ireland a sharp poke in the eye. Dell is going to cut 1,900 manufacturing jobs at its factory in Limerick in the west of Ireland. As happens when big manufacturers pull out, the move could trigger thousands more job losses down the line. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London that would mean bad things for Ireland's appeal to foreign manufacturers.
Dell has been credited with helping create the Celtic Tiger. The company is Ireland's largest exporter, accounting for 5% of GDP. Today's decision to shed almost half its workforce is devastating, says Parliament member for Limerick, Jan O'Sullivan.
Losing 1,900 jobs, plus a very large number of knock-on jobs in other industries that are ancillary to Dell, is an enormous blow, and there really is a huge pall of gloom around Limerick today.
Dell says the move is part of a global $3 billion cost-cutting drive. The production in Limerick will be shifted to a new factory in Poland. Maria Kelly of the Limerick Chamber of Commerce accepts the logic of the move. Ireland has become a high-cost economy.
Dell's two biggest competitors, Hewlett-Packard and IBM, already produce their PCs in low-cost economies, and I think we knew it was inevitable that Dell would be moving in a similar way.
But economist David McWilliams fears what he calls the multinationals' herd mentality. They arrived in Ireland en masse. Now Dell could trigger an exodus.
Once one begins to leave, it almost facilitates the decision, which was in the back of the head of the others, that maybe Poland is the new Ireland. And what we did for the last 30 years, the Poles will do better for the next 30 years.
Today, Dell described the Irish job cuts as a difficult decision, but the right one to deliver greater value to its customers. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The major indices turned in a split decision. Today, we will have the details when we do the numbers. Given how he did in Beijing, Michael Phelps is one of the first who comes to mind when we think of Olympic athletes. The guy seems to be on TV every 5 seconds doing a commercial for something or other. In fact, just this week, he became the spokesperson for Mazda in China. But not all Olympians are rich. In fact, most of them aren't, and by a long shot, too. There was a reminder today of just how hard some of them have to work to be able to compete. For the past 16 years, Home Depot has been giving hundreds of American athletes full pay and benefits to work part-time while they train. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports that program may have just become the latest victim of the recession.
Derek Parra knows his way around the ice rink. He won a gold and a silver for speed skating at the 2002 Olympics. He also knows his way around the electrical and hardware sections of Home Depot. This was a typical day during his 7 years in the Home Depot Olympian program.
Get to the rink by 8, get on the ice at 9, skate from 9 to 11, get to the Home Depot by noon, work from noon to 4, come back to the oval by about 4:30, warm up, stretch out.
And despite all that hard work, he says it was the only way to live out his dreams and pay the bills.
Without a doubt, 100% certainty, I would have never made it to the Games in 02 if it wasn't for the program.
Parra describes the program's cancellation as a dagger through the hearts of tomorrow's athletes. Home Depot denies the cancellation is related to the economy. Here's spokesperson Jean Nimi.
We're sad to see it come to an end, but we have been a sponsor for 16 years and feel the time has come to move on.
William Chips of IEG Sponsorship Report says a number of companies are making the same determination about their marketing efforts. After years of double-digit growth in sponsorship, he's predicting an increase of only 2% this year.
Granted, companies are facing a new kind of economic reality, and they are facing new financial challenges, but at the end of the day, they still need to market their products and services.
And he says sponsorship does have a unique ability to connect on an emotional level with consumers. As for the Home Depot athletes, the U.S. Olympic Committee says it will give them stipends for the next year. What happens after that may depend on just how fast the economic recovery comes. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
College football season comes to a close tonight with a BCS championship game, Florida versus Oklahoma. Both teams are 12-1, both have Heisman Trophy winners playing quarterback, and both schools, the University of Florida and the University of Oklahoma, are going to make a whole lot of money out of tonight's game. That might be why the BCS is still around, despite the 10 years of complaining about it since the day it started. Diana Nyad is here to weigh in. Hey, Diana.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right. A little sick, but, you know, getting
over. I'm sorry.
Let's talk college football, and let's just stipulate here for a second that the BCS is ridiculously complicated, right?
Complicated is an understatement.
All right. What are the economic incentives that keep this thing alive?
I would call it selective greed. It would be different if it was just a huge pile of money, which it is, $96 million in revenue last year. And if that was to be split among all teams, then we could understand it, but it's not. The big boys, you know, which are the Big 12, the Big East, the SEC,
the big conferences,
those are the guys who get to qualify for the big bowl games. You can qualify if you're a smaller one like Utah did this year, but it's pretty tough. And in the end, the big boys, every time you make it into a BCS game, you're going to get $17 million, whether you win or lose, and that's going to be split among just the teams in your conference. If you're a little guy, and you did go all the way to qualify, you get the $17 million too, but it's not only split in your conference. All the five conferences split that. So it's the big boys get the lion's share, and the little boys get the peanuts.
What about the other sources of revenue, though? I mean, there are television deals, there's licensing. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but again, that's very selective. Like the Rose Bowl, you know, does not want to enter into some non-BCS program because they've got a sweet TV deal that goes all the way through 2014. And they've got, you know, big money in the Rose Bowl parade and all kinds of sponsorships, you know, that they have on their own, negotiated on their own. So all of a sudden, if it becomes a big equitable pie, you know, they are going to fight and scratch to make sure that doesn't happen, as are all those big boy conferences.
Let's remember why the BCS was established. It was, at least in name, to figure out a true legitimate national champion.
Yeah.
Has it done that?
Well, of course it hasn't. Look at tonight. The University of Florida and Oklahoma are going to play for what they call the national title game in Miami.
Right.
When it gets over, I mean, my gosh, the Attorney General of Utah is filing a suit against the BCS.
Antitrust suit, right?
An antitrust suit saying that Utah should have had every right to play in that national game. They're the undefeated team of the year, 13-0, whereas both teams playing tonight had losses. They've got a great case to make. And guess what? In the next week, if the Associated Press and coaches polls, which decide all these things, vote that Utah or Southern California or Texas is really the national champion, tonight's game is totally meaningless. It's the most absurd thing that happens in sport, I'm telling you.
How do you really feel about it? But here's the thing. Much as these guys are student athletes and they're supposed to be college students, college football is an enormous moneymaker. What are the chances of real reform when you have this much money on the line?
There have been umpteen proposals as to how to fix this. The one that I like the best is take all 120 teams and put a real true scientific computerized layout of how they do during the year, which counts, you know, all those crazy things like what was the weather that day, was it home field advantage, and then the best eight teams at the end by those computer rankings go into those four big bowls, the Rose, the Sugar, the Fiesta, and the Orange, and then the winners of those go into a semifinal, and then the two winners of those go into a final. It's reform that even adds more revenue. That's what doesn't make sense to me, Kai. But here's the point, as I said before it's been selective greed. Now let's get down to just overall greed and let everybody share in that pie.
The Business of Sports from Diana Nyad. Thanks, Diana.
Feel better, Kai.
Thanks. Coming up, less butter for your buck.
Of course. It's deceptive. Yeah. They don't bring out a big ad and say, we're going to charge you more or the same and give you 2 ounces less.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 27 points today, just shy of a third of 1%, closed at 8,742. The NASDAQ rose 17 points, 1.1%, landed at 1617, neatly sequential. The S&P 500 nudged up 3 points, a third of 1%, wrapped up at 909.
Weak December sales sent investors to the return counter as Walmart shares fell 7.5%. Stock in Macy's also down more than 3% there. But some other retailers managed gains in the face of those sales, whereas JCPenney shares rose 2%. Target rang up more than 1%. Oil prices fell another 2% today on the heels of yesterday's 12% slide. But since refiners are paying less for crude, their stocks benefited. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips up more than 1% apiece. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want more from Marketplace's special fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for December. The House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on the Federal Housing Administration's oversight of mortgage lenders. And journalists compete for prizes in rock and roll. The National Press Club hosts Journalpalooza, a battle for the title Best Reporter-Based Washington Rock Group. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of things got this economy to where it is. Greed, or more politely, the desire to make more money and have more things. Also a lack of transparency, a lack of understanding about how all those newfangled financial instruments were going to work, or not going to work. But on top of that, there was the way we did business, and how some of the players, like the banks, were and still are structured. We're going to continue today with Taking Stock, our series of occasional conversations with people who can give us the longer view of our economic situation. Management consultant Charles Handy makes a specialty of organizational behavior. And when we spoke, I asked him why he thinks we wound up in this mess.
I think we got carried away, you know, at least the bankers did mainly. After all, for many, many centuries, making money out of money has been regarded as rather a bad thing. In fact, it used to be called usury. It still is in the Muslim world. And that's what the banks started doing. They forgot what their proper job was, in my view, which was to take money from people who had some to spare and to pass it on to people who could use it usefully and profitably. And they started inventing nice little products that they came up with, which basically were a way of making money out of money.
But from purely a business proposition, if you can't make money giving a loan, why do it at all?
That's right, but you must make sure that you don't exceed the money that you've been given by the people who are saving it. And these people went wild, actually. They went way in excess of the ratios that normally were deemed respectable, ratios of how much money they were giving out to the assets that they were looking after. They were very keen about selling things. They weren't too keen about managing the risk, because they thought that prices would forever go up. They got carried away. It's understandable. They were young. They were sitting in front of computers. They went out in the real world. They were selling, you know, interesting derivative products, which were ultimately based on house prices. But none of those people selling those things had ever visited the houses, which were the basic of their asset price, you know.
It seems to me the solution when we have one of these crises is always a variation on what I suppose you could call the big three, right? One is increased transparency. The other is increased accountability, and then some kind of regulation. But we've tried all of those things in crises past. So what's the answer this time?
Get them smaller.
Get the banks smaller.
Yeah, get the banks smaller. I'm absolutely sure. Markets work well when there are a lot of players. And then if one falls out, the whole system doesn't crash. When we create organizations that, in the words of some people, are too big to fail, what we really mean is we can't allow them to fail. So I really think that we've allowed the banks to get too big. So I think the answer is basically to destructure them. I think we'll see that happening. I think we'll see Citigroup splitting itself up into much smaller kinds of entities. I also think we really should stop everybody putting everything in one basket. I think investment banking should be separated out from retail banking. They contaminate each other.
Does the government come in and regulate them smaller, or do we wait for the market, as is happening, it seems, in Citigroup's case,
to make them smaller?
Well, it'd be awfully nice if the market happens and did it, because I really don't want government poking its nose in as much as it seems to want to. But I think in the end, the government has to act if the banks don't do it.
What about the issue, though, of shared blame? Because while certainly Wall Street and Canary Wharf had their share of responsibility, it's not just them. It's the mortgage brokers, it's appraisers who appraised houses at values too high, but also it's us, right? I mean, we all spent too much money because we could.
Well, absolutely. We got carried away. Can I read you a quote that Adam Smith made 250 years ago, which always pleased me? He said, "A profitable speculation is presented as a public good because growth will stimulate demand and everywhere diffuse comfort and improvement. No patriot or man of feeling could therefore oppose it. But the nature of this growth, in opposition, for example, to older ideas such as cultivation, is that it is at once undirected and infinitely self-generating in the endless demand for all the useless things in the world."
So now what then? I mean, if Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations that we all know about, if he's right and we got it wrong 250 years later, now what do we do?
Well, I think governments are faced with a difficult problem. They are trying to get people to spend, but it does seem a rather un-Adam Smith idea to get people to go out shopping in order to get the economy going again. More useless things, in other words. But in order to get that happening, they have reduced the base rate from the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England in order to get people finding it easier to borrow. But actually, there are more savers than borrowers in society. And so, of course, now the savers are not going to save because there's no incentive to it. So I'm not sure that the solution is going to be easy to get by. And I think it'll take about 3 years for things to bottom out. But there may be some good news in all that. I mean, we may get back to a saner kind of world, what Adam Smith called cultivation or civilization, where we don't all sort of spend our life trying to make money to buy things we don't really need to impress the neighbors and so on, where we actually do work not 60 hours a week, but 40 hours a week, where we actually do take holidays, where we actually get to know our kids again, where it actually becomes smart to have a tiny car, to walk and bicycle and these sorts of things. And we may find we enjoy it, actually, just as much as the hectic pace that we've seen in recent years. I've often said that capitalism, particularly in America, is a very exhausting business. It tires people out.
Well, Charles Handy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Charles Handy founded the London Business School. These days, he's a management consultant and a writer. His most recent book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. When you go to the market for a weekly groceries run, you can count on certain things. You buy a gallon of milk, you get a gallon. A pound of apples is a pound of apples. But without peeking now, how many ounces are there in a box of Fruit Loops? How about a package of Dial soap? The answer is less than there were before. Companies are reducing the weight of some of their products, yet charging the same amount. Is this a subtle way to raise prices? Yes, definitely. Is it deceptive? Perhaps. Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
The poster product for this phenomenon is Skippy peanut butter. The regular-sized jar looks the same as always, until you turn it upside down.
The jar used to have a smooth bottom. It now has an indentation, which takes a couple of ounces of peanut butter out of the product.
Frank Luby is a marketing and pricing consultant for Simon Kucher and Partners in Cambridge, Mass. He says that big dimple in the bottom of the Skippy jar
allows them to keep the same price point, but you get slightly less.
I guess my follow-up question to all of this is, what the hell? Is that okay?
To be perfectly honest, I think it is okay.
With the price of commodities going up this year, Luby says, shrinking containers might be the lesser of three evils. The other two being cheaper ingredients, which would change the taste of your peanut butter, or alienating even the most loyal customers with higher shelf prices. Now, Skippy is made by Unilever, a food conglomerate that also put a dent in the bottom of Hellman's mayonnaise and shrank your carton of Breyer's ice cream. No one there would go on tape, but when I raised the deception question, a spokesman said the new weight is clearly marked on the package. And Frank Luby says the per ounce and per pound labels on the grocery shelf really help.
So, yes, it's deceptive, but I think it would be even more deceptive if you didn't have that level playing field that's created by the per-ounce comparisons, which we can take a close look at when we go to the supermarket.
The supermarket down the road from his office.
And I want to go look at the box of Total.
Total cereal, his brand.
I grabbed this box, and this is relatively thin.
It looks really thin.
It looks really thin.
Whereas the face of the box looks as wide as always. General Mills, which makes Total, told me it only shrank down some of its cereal sizes, that the smaller ones are now cheaper, and that this is old news. And as Luby and I were checking out that famous dent in the Skippy jar...
How deep is that, would you say?
It's probably as deep as a fingernail.
We got kicked out of the store.
Okay, I can't even be recording in the store or filming without permission from headquarters.
Okay. Do you mind if I buy these?
You can buy them, yeah.
Okay, great. So I went to the checkout counter with two boxes of Total and a jar of Skippy.
Oh, $11.27, wow.
Way more than I thought it was going to cost.
Okay, I'm whipping out $2 more here.
All the money in my wallet. And Luby says that proves the point.
You're going to remember that that cost you more than what you expected, and that's going to stick with you. But the package sizes, to the extent that you knew them anyway before you started working on this story, will continue to fade.
But I'm not so sure. Because I went to another grocery store, bought a bunch of downsized items, and did a little show-and-tell with folks in the parking lot. Peggy Pellegrino and her friend June Mackey were so mad about this issue, you could barely understand them.
Oh, they all are. With the hole peanut butter, on the bottom, the Hellman's like mayonnaise.
So you know about this?
Yeah. Of course we do.
Really?
We're sure informed consumers.
It's disgusting, Peggy said. Disgusting. But is it deceptive, I said.
Of course. It's deceptive. Yeah. They don't bring out a big ad and say, we're going to charge you more or the same and give you 2 ounces less.
Not only
they
that.
They make you find out for yourself.
Not only that, it's harder to scrape it out at the bottom with the indented thing.
Others in the parking lot had a different take. They said consumers have to watch out for themselves. But pretty much everyone said they'd rather just pay more for the original-sized products. Oh, and this radio story was reduced from 4.5 minutes to 3:15. So, in Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the good people over at the NASDAQ have been wondering the same thing we have. What's a good way to track how bailed out companies are performing with all that government cash they've got? Enter the newest stock ticker you're going to want to be keeping track of. The OMX Government Relief Index includes companies that have taken TARP money. Not all of them, just the ones that got $1 billion or more. Here's the kicker, though. The index started trading Monday at an initial value of 1,000, just as a baseline. Closed today at 941. It's going to be a long year, gang. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 27 points, just under a third of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 17 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That's a third of 1% there. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, bankers and their bling.
You're making, you know, maybe like 90 to 100 grand a year, but you're kind of acting and living like you make like 5 million.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.